This is Sin Holder.
Dr. John Eichert, Professor Emeritus of Agriculture and Applied Economics, University of Missouri-Columbia, delivered a presentation on sustainable agriculture in Hotchkiss earlier this month. I had the opportunity to talk with him about sustainability here at KVNF. You're Professor Emeritus in Agricultural Economics, and since retiring, you spend a lot of time speaking about issues related to sustainable agriculture. And you've written several books, The Essentials of Economic Sustainability, Sustainable Capitalism, Small Farms and Real Farms. You have answers to very complicated questions. What created this interest to devote your life to this?
Well, I started out in my professional career as a very traditional agricultural economist. I grew up on a small farm and then went to University of Missouri, and I got interested in agricultural economics, and then I ended up getting a PhD degree in agricultural economics and spent the first half of my academic career really as a very conventional sort of bottom line farming as a business sort of advisor to people in agriculture and farmers in particular. But in the 1980s, during what I refer to as the farm financial crisis, I came to the conclusion that the agricultural economics that I'd been taught and that I'd been teaching farmers simply wasn't working. That was a time, what I referred to as the farm financial crisis, when farmers had invested during the 1970s when times were profitable and had bought land and equipment and built up high debts at high interest rates, and then the international markets collapsed in the 1980s and they were caught with large debts that they couldn't pay off. And I could see family farmers going broke and losing their farms and bankruptcies and farm suicides. I could see rural communities that were in decline and decay that depended upon those farm families. And then only later I come to the realization of the erosion, the pollution of the environment by this industrial agriculture that I'd helped create, telling farmers to farm for the economic bottom line, be prepared to get bigger, get out of agriculture, and these sorts of things. And it just wasn't working. And so I couldn't continue to do that. I had to change directions in mid-career, and then that's when I become involved in sustainable agriculture. Sustainable agriculture, it's about economic viability, long-run economic viability, but it's a realization that to have long-run economic sustainability, you have to take care of the land and you have to care for communities. You have to take care of those natural and human resources upon which the long-run economic viability of agriculture depends. So that just started me on a long journey, and ever since I've continued to try to understand this evolving issue of agricultural sustainability. How do we meet the needs of the present without diminishing opportunities for the future? And that's what's brought me here.
What are the three economies of sustainability?
Well, when people talk about sustainability, they typically talk about ecological soundness, ecological integrity, social responsibility, and then economic viability. And what that relates to is, if we talk about sustainability in general within agriculture and elsewhere, as I indicated, it's about meeting the needs of the present, all the people in the present, but without diminishing opportunities for those of the future. And it's a recognition that everything of economic value, meaning things essential for economic viability, comes from nature, comes from the natural ecosystems or natural systems by way of society, by way of human beings, in the case of farmers that farm the land, that bring the productivity. But all throughout society, it's everything that's of any use to us comes from the natural resources, comes from air and water and soil and minerals and energy. But if you move beyond self-sufficiency, then you have to relate to other people in some way, whether you're bartering or whether you're buying or selling. So economic viability depends upon ecological integrity and social integrity. So you have to have all three of those things if you're going to have long-run sustainability.
I'm curious if you think that there has been a shift or a paradigm shift. Is the Industrial Revolution over?
I think it is. I think we're in a period that I call a great transition. Every 200 years or so in Western society, we've gone through these periods of time whenever we basically are forced to change our way of thinking about how the world works and where we fit within it. And ultimately, these great transitions change virtually every aspect of our life. And I think what we're in now is at least as big as the Industrial Revolution. It's probably as big as the beginning of science. I think we're really rethinking the whole concept of how the world works and where we fit. The scientific revolution was based on kind of a mechanistic paradigm of how the world works. The world was a big complex mechanism. And then that kind of laid the groundwork then for the Industrial Revolution, which was much, very much a kind of a mechanical approach of specialization, standardization, consolidation, you know, make farms and fields work like factories, make factories work like machines. So it was all this mechanistic sort of mindset. And whereas that's a very efficient means of extracting the usefulness from nature and from society, there's nothing in that particular paradigm or model that provides any incentive for regeneration or renewal of the natural and human resources that it requires for long-run sustainability. So what we see in agriculture with respect to that, we see farms that are based on kind of that industrial model, and that's what I was teaching during the first half of my academic career, and that's what I was taught, that we got to specialize farms. We moved away from diversified family farms to large specialized farming operations. First, it was crops and livestock, then particular phases of crop and livestock production. So we went to specialization. And then when you specialize, then you have to standardize those individual operations so that they all fit together. So once you've standardized, then you can mechanize and routinize and simplify, and then you can consolidate into larger and larger production units, which means you accomplish economies of scale. But it all goes back to kind of this industrial paradigm. So we would make the farm work like a machine. We'd make the farm work like a factory. You know, kind of fields and feedlots were biological assembly lines in a sense. So it all came out of that kind of mechanistic way of thinking in the industrial sort of paradigm. While that's tremendously efficient, it's simply not sustainable because there's no economic incentive to make the long-term investments that are necessary to sustain the integrity of the natural resource base or the human resource base that it takes for long-run economic sustainability.
When you speak about long-run sustainability, it seems to me that there's an inherent contradiction in capitalism and sustainability.
I think there is if you take capitalism as being totally kind of unrestrained free market approach to how you do things. I like to separate value. There's three basic kinds of value. There's economic value, and economic value is inherently individual. It accrues to the individual, not to the family, community, society. Makes no economic sense to do anything for the benefit of society as a whole if you don't get anything back out of it as an individual. It's instrumental. It's always a means to an end. There's always the expectation that you'll get something back in return. And then it's impersonal. You have to be able to buy, sell, trade something if it has economic value. It can be of tremendous personal value, but if you can't trade it to somebody else, it has no economic value. So when you think about it from that standpoint with respect to sustainability, if you allow a system to be driven solely by economic value, which is what capitalism unrestrained is about, it makes absolutely no economic sense to invest in anything if the benefit is expected to come after you're dead. You know, you're not going to be here to receive any benefit. And it's instrumental, so you're always making an investment with the expectation of return. Now, you know, that may seem pretty obvious, but if you relate to that, life's inherently uncertain. And you don't know if you'll realize as much value out of something next week or next year as you would if you have it now. So the economy, economic value, puts a premium on the present relative to the future. So if you allow decisions to be made solely based on economic value, which is what free market capitalism is all about, then you're going to discount the future to the extent that you're not going to make the future investments. And that's the problem that we have today. I think we've created an unsustainable economy, an unsustainable society. Now, let me add very quickly that the classical capitalists, they understood that the economy had to function within the context of a society, where society placed constraints on what the economy would do, and society would come together and make investments collectively for the long-run good of that society, investments that had no economic value, but investments that would maintain the productivity of the natural resources, that would maintain a healthy environment, and investments that would maintain the overall integrity of society as a whole, rather than leaving those things to the market. So capitalism in the sense of totally unrestrained free markets is simply not sustainable. But if you take the classical form of capitalism where the economy functions within the constraints and within the bounds of society that prevents doing things for economic value if they're degrading of the natural environment or destructive of society that prevents those things, then you can have a sustainable capitalism.
To me, it's almost as if you're talking about Jeffersonian and Hamiltonian ideology. And that we have basically embraced Hamiltonian economics over the last 150 years, and that perhaps we're seeing that we need to go back to more of a Jeffersonian style.
I think you have it exactly right. I think we've been going back and forth between this all the way going back to the enclosures of in Europe in the 1600s and really come into the 1700s. That's kind of when the enclosures, we went more to a market economy. But that was the reflection of the debate between Hamilton and Jefferson. Jefferson was more, we've got to focus on society and the greater common good, and we've got to make government work to ensure the basic rights of people and maintain individual freedoms and not allow, he warned about corporate interest collection so that you would move toward where you'd have greater and greater market power and greater influence over society. And then Hamilton, was arguing in favor of more totally free markets, let the markets work, let the markets allocate resources, minimum amount of government, lack of government interference. And we've kind of been bouncing back and forth between that ever since Jefferson and Hamilton. And I think more recently, though, if you look at the early 1900s, we came into the, World War I and then the Great Depression. Prior to the Great Depression, it was very much a time very similar to what we have today, where the free market philosophy was prevailing and we had the growing disparity between the wealthy and the rest of society at that time. It's called the Gilded Age. We're back to something very similar to that. But then when we come into the Great Depression, the market wasn't self-correcting as the free market economists said it would be, and we went into the Depression. And then as a consequence of that, then we move more back toward the Jeffersonian kind of concept of democracy. And that's when we had the New Deal programs of the Roosevelt era, and that kind of evolved into the Great Society programs of the Johnson era. And then you had a rejection of that, so to speak, and we come into the Reagan era where they said, get the government off the back, the government is a problem. And so now we've swung back toward this kind of free market sort of philosophy of saying, okay, let's minimize the size of governments and let the markets work, and that's the best solution to what we're in today. So I think we've just been bouncing back and forth between those things. But I think something that's different today than we've ever had before is the growing environmental and ecological problems that we have today are on a global scale, whereas we've never had a time when a civilization has been confronted with what we have today that's been kind of a global economy and a global society as opposed to a particular nation. So I think it makes it very imperative for us to kind of get the things right, not just get the prices right, but get the principles and get the purpose right at this particular point in time. Not just in agriculture. It's certainly important in agriculture, and, that's kind of what I'm here to talk about. But I think we need to understand that what's happening in agriculture is just one piece of what's happening at a much larger scale, at a global scale, and it's happening in the economy overall, and it's happening in society overall. I got interested in these because I could see that agriculture wasn't sustainable. But as I looked deeper and deeper as to why agriculture wasn't sustainable, I came to the conclusion that the whole economy wasn't sustainable. And even broader than that, our whole society wasn't sustainable. And so I think agriculture is a good place to start because I think the problems are more apparent in agriculture. It's obvious in agriculture that all the productivity comes from the land. It comes from nature. And I think it's obvious in agriculture the relationship between the farmer and the consumer and the land, how all that connection is there. But those same principles hold all the way throughout society. So I think agriculture is a good place to start to kind of recreate a sustainable system of agriculture as a model for a sustainable economy and a sustainable society.
More people are living in cities now than they are living in rural communities. So how do you teach sustainability to people that have never lived on a farm or have no experience with nature?
Well, we really have an old urban food movement that's going on today. It's what's happening in terms of sustainable agriculture is not just out in rural areas on farms, but it's also in the urban areas. And I think there's people that are working on that. But it will be a major issue. We're going to have a lot more urban gardens, which we have today, and there's going to be a lot more people that come together and kind of have food hubs that hook people up or connect people in urban areas with people on the surrounding farms and things of this nature. But I think it's all this process of kind of reconnect with the land, get people to understanding of it, that food comes from the land, that we're biological beings, that we're as dependent today on those farms out here as we were, or on the earth for our being, as we were in the times when we were hunters and gatherers, and we're as dependent upon the farmers today as we were back in the early 1900s. And so I think when people begin to realize that connection between the land and the food, then we'll have a growing realization that we have to take care of the land in order to provide for the food needs of people. And I think part of that will evolve out of growing concerns, as you see on the public concerns today, about the food supply in general. I think there's more and more questions that are being asked among the general public about what I would call the integrity of the food supply. I'll talk a little bit during my presentations here about a sort of a major public relations program that's been put together by what I call the agricultural establishment. This would include the agribusiness corporations, the large specialized commodity organizations, organizations like the Farm Bureau that basically promotes the industrial vision of agriculture as well. I don't think they would deny that. So they have a major kind of nationwide public relations campaign that have been put together with millions of dollars. The first I saw was like $8 or $9 million for the first year. I don't know what the budget is now. A lot of that's coming from the big agribusiness corporations and the commodity associations, which gets their money from checkoffs from the livestock producers, a lot of those in the big CAFO operations. And they've got four major areas that they're focusing on, and one of those is food safety. And what they're doing is they're trying to address growing public concerns, and they say this on their website, the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance. If you go look at their website, they'll say, here's these four concerns, and these are areas in which the public has growing concerns, and we want to address those concerns, as they would say. So they see this as a mounting problem. The first that they talk about is food safety. The second is environmental problems. We talked about all of those except food safety. The third is animal welfare issues. And the fourth is kind of what they call consumer choice or price. They're basically saying these things are economic necessity. But I think kind of the Achilles heel of industrial agriculture is this whole food safety and food quality issue. And there's a growing number of people within society that are beginning to realize there's something fundamentally wrong with the food system. First of all, you know, going back to kind of why I got involved in industrial agriculture and how it relates to this is I was convinced from what I had been taught and kind of what I understood that if we made agriculture more efficient, then we were going to make good, wholesome food affordable and accessible to everyone. Well, you know, it simply didn't work. First of all, we've got as many people that are hungry or food insecure in this country percentage-wise as we had back in the 1960s. About 15%, the last statistics I could find, of the people are classified as food insecure. Almost a quarter of our children are in food insecure homes. So we didn't feed the hungry by industrializing agriculture. But back to the other issue of food safety and nutrition, the people that can afford to buy food, particularly those at the lower income levels, the food that they're getting is making them sick. We've got an epidemic of obesity in this country, and it's not just a matter of embarrassment or inconvenience. It's associated with an epidemic of diabetes and heart disease and high blood pressure and numerous cancers that are associated with that. And that goes back to the American diet. There were people back in the 30s and 40s that said, as we go to industrial agriculture, as we allow some of the most respected people in the scientific community of that time, as we allow agriculture to be driven by economics rather than a concern for food quality and taking care of the health of the soil, then what we will end up with is producing foods that are high in calories but lacking in essential nutrients. And they said people basically will overeat on calories trying to get enough of those essential nutrients for good health. And I call it kind of the Albrecht hypothesis. William Albrecht was the one that that I read that talked about these things. He was head of the American Soil Science Association, head of the American Agronomy Association at this time. The Albrecht hypothesis is that you'll end up with a nation of people that are overfed and undernourished, and I think that's what we're seeing. And whereas a lot of people may not understand, you know, may not interpret it the same way I do, I think there's a growing realization there's something fundamentally wrong with the food system. It isn't feeding the hungry people, and we've got a growing health-related problems, healthcare problems that are associated with our diet. If you added in the health problems. Well, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation did a study, and they estimated that if current trends continue, by the year 2020, 20% of our health care costs would be associated with obesity and the related diseases. And if you add into that the problems that are associated with agricultural chemicals, which are well documented, a range of those endocrine disruptors and various other things, and the antibiotic resistance, which increasingly is associated with large-scale confinement animal feeding operations, we're probably talking about a third, maybe even a half, of the total health care cost of this country is associated with the American diet. And when people begin to come to the realization of that, they'll say, okay, you know, maybe you sold us on this idea that we were going to bring down the cost of food. And we did as a percentage of disposable income. Between, I think it was 1970 and 2010 or whatever, we cut the amount we spend on food of our disposable income from almost 20% down to less than 10%. But during that same period of time, we increased the amount that we spent on health care from 9% to 18%. We doubled the amount we spent on health care. And I think people are going to come to the realization, hey, if we're simply going to offset any savings that we have on food costs with increased health care costs and we end up sick, it's not just an economic matter. We end up with a nation of sick people that are less productive and less able to participate in society. We need a new food system. We need a food revolution, and I think that's basically what it's going to take. It's going to take a revolution, basically, on the part of consumers and taxpayers to a certain extent, because we're supporting this industrial agriculture through agricultural policy that costs us as taxpayers. We're going to have a revolution on the part of consumers and taxpayers and say, hey, we want a food system that really provides everyone with affordable, safe, accessible food, enough food to support a basically healthy, active lifestyle, which is what food security is.
So in other words, you're saying cheap food isn't really cheap food.
That's right. I say over and over again, we can't afford the cost of cheap food. The health care costs, the environmental costs, the cost of rural communities, cost of society as a whole, the cost of kind of the growing disconnectedness of people from any sense of connection to the earth and the disconnectedness within our rural community. And I think what the local food movement is about, what the organic food movement was about originally, was very much in line with sustainable agriculture. If you go back and the people like Sir Albert Howard and J.I. Rodale and Rudolf Steiner back in the early 1900s, they talked about creating a permanent agriculture, healthy soils, healthy crops, healthy people, a permanent agriculture for a permanent society. There was a commitment to this concept of long sustainability, and there was this commitment to a holistic sort of process, the interconnection of the farmer with the land and the community, and all of that was kind of an interrelated whole. And I think that's what the local food movement is about. It started out in the organic, and then slowly over time, we moved more and more through standardization of organics. Then we kind of come to what I call industrialization of organics. When we set the national standards, it says whoever can meet those minimum standards at the lowest cost basically is going to take the market. And those standards, the national standards, don't ensure the ecological and social integrity of that system. There's nothing in it, for example, on animal welfare issues. And there's really not much in it in terms of environmental issues. It's mainly just reducing the agricultural chemicals and changing the practices. And I think what the local food movement is about is it's kind of among those people that are really looking for what I call ecological and social integrity in the food. And they realize the only way you're really going to maintain that in the long run is have some sense of personal connectedness to the people that you're getting your food from. And through them, a sense of personal connectedness to the land, to a particular place. So I think this new food system is going to be made up of a regional, national, maybe even global networks of local community-based food systems where the integrity of that system is ensured through those personal relationships within the communities and farmers that really do care about the land and have a personal connection and a commitment to taking care of the land for the long-run benefit. We're going to have to return to farming, and I think there's many farmers that do it today, farming as a way of life and not just as a business. See, what I was teaching all those years was farming as a business. It's just like any other business. You've got to specialize, standardize, consolidate because that's more economically efficient. But historically, farming was always a way of life. It was a way of making a living, but it was a way of living as well. It was about a place to raise a family, to be a part of a community. It was about the social connectedness that you had as a farmer, and it was about the connectedness to the land and the sense of responsibility and stewardship for the land. J.I. Rodale, as I mentioned earlier, kind of the early organic pioneer, he talked about farming as being a sacred trust, a patriotic responsibility, you know, the caretaker of the earth upon which all of the society in any particular country and in the world ultimately depends. And so farming had this philosophical, ethical dimension, the social dimension, and the economic dimension. And it was all part of the same thing. And I think that's what it's going to take to farm sustainably. I think that's what it's going to take to work and live sustainably anywhere. It's just easier to see in farming. I think it's so important, the agricultural sustainability and the new food system, because I think we're creating the model or the paradigm here that will have to be replicated throughout the whole society. That great transition again, you know, it's just agriculture's piece of that great transition.
What do you see coming? Do you have a vision of the future, the next 50 years of how we'll manage this paradigm shift?
I don't know. People ask me, you know, are we going to make a change or will it be forced upon us? You know, will we have a Are we going to have a peaceful revolution or are we going to have a violent revolution? And I don't know. I think we still have time to make the transitions, to take care of the earth, to take care of each other, to make the transition to a sustainable agriculture and a sustainable society. But if we don't do it, what we're doing now simply is not sustainable. We're using up the productivity of the earth. We're poisoning the environment in which we live. And we're destroying the social integrity of our society, not just within our communities, but within global society. You know, some people say, well, we can come up with a new energy source and all this, or we'll solve our environmental problems. But if we come up with a new energy source and we just use it to blow each other up, we haven't really accomplished anything. So people ask me, well, are we going to make the transition? Kind of I talked moving to a more organic way of how the world works. The new worldview that I talk about is the world is not a big mechanism. It's a big living organism with all these interrelated parts. It's holistic, that we have to work in harmony with it, that we're not apart from nature, that nature is something that we can use. We're a part of nature. And we'll be healthy and we'll be productive only to the extent that nature as a whole is healthy and productive. But can we make that transition? Well, people ask me and I say, well, I'm not necessarily optimistic, but I'm hopeful because I know it's possible. Hope doesn't mean that you think it's going to be quick or easy or even that the odds are in your favor. But hope simply means that you know something is possible. And as long as you know something possible, then there's hope and then there's the ability to work toward it. One thing that makes me hopeful is as far as we know, we're the only species that has the ability to kind of reason through things and say, if we continue to do what we're doing, then these are going to be the consequences, even though it's never happened to any human before in history. Other animals, even plants, learn from experience. You know, plants reach for the sun, they elongate the cells, and animals can certainly learn from experience. But as far as we know, none of these other species can sit down and talk like we're talking and say, okay, this is what's happening. If we continue to do this, this is what's going to happen. So I like to remain hopeful because another thing that keeps me hopeful is I have an opportunity to go out here and work with people all around the country, around the world to a certain extent, that have this new vision that are making it work for them. They're making it work on their farms, in their communities, people involved in the local food movement, the sustainable agriculture movement. There's at least a dozen conferences around the country nowadays that would have over 1,000 people that would show up, that would be people with this alternative vision, sustainable farmers, their customers, various other people, organic, ecological farmers, a whole range of them. And the number are growing every year. Everywhere I go, there's new innovations and new creativity in local food systems. They're calling them food hubs now, or groups of farmers would get together. I see that as a real possibility in this area. You've got several farmers here that are involved in these alternative systems. If somehow they could come together and cooperate and put together kind of a multi-farm operation where you could offer the customers meat, milk, eggs, vegetables, fruits, honey, a whole range of things, make it a little more accessible to the local customers, maybe even serve the recreation areas that you have here where people could come over here and visit and go on the wine tasting and taste local foods, a whole range of things. There's things like this that are happening all across the country. And so that's the reason I remained hopeful. It's still small. It's not the dominant food system. It's not going to be quick. It's not going to be easy. But I know that it's possible and that there's hope.
Professor Eichert, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
That was Sin Holder speaking with John Eichard last month in Paonia. Eichard is a professor emeritus of agricultural economics at the University of Missouri. He's the author of Sustainable Capitalism, A Return to Common Sense, and Small Farms Are Real Farms. John Eichard was in the North Fork to speak at a sustainable farming workshop organized by the Delta Conservation District. Thanks for listening to Local Motion on KVNF. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the treatment.